Welcome to the Fuller Money Audio Commentary. This is David Fuller recording on the 6th of December, 2009. Now, this is a special audio recording that I decided to prepare to accompany a PowerPoint presentation that I prepared for the dealers group conferences for the independent financial advisors at which I spoke last week. Now, I decided to record the audio because I always share my off-site work, as it were, with paid-up subscribers to the Fuller Money Global Strategy Service. But also, I thought this is a good opportunity for me to demonstrate in the public area, in the free section of the Fuller Money website, to visitors, new visitors to the site. We like to think of you as pre-subscribers, to show you exactly what our methodology at Fuller Money is and how we reach some of the conclusions that we do reach. And of course, those of you who visit the site can also visit the historic archives and listen to audios at certain points throughout market history to see what we were saying at the time and also see what we were writing about markets at that time. But now let's concentrate on the current and PowerPoint presentation and the points that I would like to share with you. But by way of introduction, what subscribers of course do know is that I'm a career analyst. I've been involved in markets in a professional capacity since the mid-1960s, and from 1970 onwards, I've been based in London, where I have been developing the Fuller Money service overall. And Fuller Money today is a division within StockCube Research Limited, an independent research company, and I am also a director and founder of StockCube Research Limited. Now, you'll notice that my title at Fuller Money and also at StockCube is Global Strategist. And some of you may think, well, what's a global strategist? It sounds like a jack of all trades and a master of none. And you would be right in that perception, and because we do look at a lot of different things, and one can't always do it in vast depth, because there just wouldn't be enough time in any given day. I've often said myself that I would like to have a 40-hour day rather than a 24-hour day. But let's move now to the next slide, where I discuss how global strategists actually work. And I speak for myself and for my colleague Owen Tracy. We read a great deal. We probably spend more time reading than almost anything else. We read a lot of fundamental economic reports. We also want to know and have learned over the decades a great deal about market history. And I think that that's something that I would commend to any of you. If you're interested in investing, you'll be interested in market history, but it is so important because what goes around does come around again eventually. And we need to know how markets have responded in the past to various criteria, not least financial crises, a major one of which we have come through in the last year. We also need to use a lot of common sense, and I will hope that common sense will be evident in some of the appraisals that I make in this audio. I would say also that common sense is the type of intelligence that we have to develop during the course of our lives, and it's the most useful one in terms of assessing market opportunities. But last and most of all, we read price charts. We look at hundreds of price charts, and in our libraries, we have thousands of price charts. We would look perhaps on any given market day, we would look at easily 100 price charts during the course of that day, probably more. And there's no other way that I can think of in that we can actually monitor, observe what's actually going on. And I'll leave it to Yogi Berra to have the last word on why we should all look at price charts. Now, I'll also mention the Fuller Money philosophy. And basically, we feel that the world is your oyster in terms of opportunities. I'm not biased, I hope, towards any particular market for or against, but I have always regarded them as man-made resources for us to harvest when the timing is right. And a key to that timing factor, I feel, is what we are actually able to see on the price charts, although valuations will provide a background to some of those timing calls. Now, looking at the next slide and talking about technical analysis. First, there are a lot of different approaches to technical analysis, and people often become confused with the subject. Also, all fields have their own jargon, which outsiders can find tedious, certainly I do. If you've this is not unique to technical analysis, of course. If you read economic reports, as we occasionally do, you'll see there's plenty of jargon there. And if you've ever read a lawyer's brief, I have seldom seen documents containing more jargon than those. But we do have a practical approach to our technical analysis, in that we focus entirely on chart facts, not chart theories. Now, what are chart facts? Well, is the market trending or is it ranging? If it's trending, is it trending consistently, which would suggest that it is still in motion, or is it has it lost that consistency and become really quite choppy, which would indicate disagreement that supply and demand was back in balance and that perhaps a struggle was going on between buyers and sellers, at which we often see at top formations and also at bottom formations. I don't know any other way to discern that evidence without looking at price charts. And lastly, I've long described myself as a technical naturalist. Now, not naturist, those are people who take the clothes off, but a technical naturalist. And think David Attenborough. In other words, I envisage him, you know, peering through the shrubs, seeing the herd, watching the herd begin to move in a new direction. And that, I feel, is what we do. And I want to move with the herd in terms of global investors, not in the opposite direction, because I might not, for some particular reason, agree with what the herd of investors is actually doing. Now, let's look at the next slide, where I have a 10-year weekly chart of gold. And I'll just mention a few consistency characteristics about gold. I've chosen gold because it's the best bull market going since the beginning of the decade, since that low that you can see in 2001. And also because it's a market of considerable interest, certainly to ourselves, has been all along throughout this recovery, and remain so today. Now, several things you can see quite clearly. And I also mentioned that we've put an overlay on here with a 200-day moving average. As this is a weekly chart, that is also a 40-week moving average, which is a trend smoothing device. And we use this in terms of regression. I'll say more about this on latter slides, but basically, in an overall upward trend, as you see with gold, if it pulls up and away from the moving average too far, it becomes vulnerable or susceptible to a reversion towards the mean. And I think of the mean, again, as being the 200-day moving average in terms of the trend mean. Now, what you can see, what I think is quite remarkable on this chart, if you look at where the arrows are actually, the green arrows are actually placed, that gold has had an extraordinary cycle in recent years, in that it will experience these consolidations of approximately 18 months, a little longer in the first one that you see, and then a breakout occurring in September 2005. And then gold rallies, I think, a little over $300 over the next two quarters or more, and then moves into another consolidation period. And I think this one was 18 months before breaking out in September 2007. So again, precisely 2 years later, breaking out to the upside. And this is something that we discussed earlier in the year, because you could see that gold was in this consolidation pattern, ranging this largely sideways, aside from the sharp dip downwards during the height of the financial crisis when people were selling everything. But gold rebounded early on, had an October low, moved right back up to its highs, and then ranged sideways, and lo and behold, repeated that pattern, which can often become behavioral, by breaking out in to the upside in September 2009. And here we are in December, and you can see that it has pulled away from that 200-day moving average trend smoothing device, which I've also referred to as the trend mean. And so, not surprisingly, you might feel that gold is susceptible, as we do, to a pause, a reaction, and consolidation. I don't think that it will be violent, because I don't think that the upside cycle is over for this particular move. So it'll look like some of those smaller reactions and consolidations that you can see within this 10-year trend. In other words, maybe gold trades in primarily the 1,200 to mid to slightly lower $1,100 range during a consolidation, which is a pause for breath, and it allows some profit-taking to occur, the market to become less overbought. We saw some of that, of course, on Friday's pullback before gold resumes its overall upward trend. Now, on pause moves, we have seen to the upside, which you can see from the breakout points, again, drawn by the green arrows, that gold has seen rises of approximately $300, and that those have taken place over a 6 to 8 month period. And I see no reason on the chart evidence why this would not be the same. So I continue to look for a move to at least the $1,300 level in the next few months. And I think gold will be moving higher well into the first quarter of this year, but may reach a more important peak sometime between March and May. That's when we saw the last two peaks that you can see on those charts, last two important peaks on that chart, before it goes into a longer pause. Now, Of course, there's nothing etched in granite that gold has to perform that way, but it has remained remarkably consistent throughout this move. And it's a market that we like a lot and have liked for quite a long time. And I think the basic story is that gold, as we've been saying for pretty well the last decade, is gradually being remonetized in the eyes of investors. And they like gold because it's also a supply inelasticity story. It's difficult to produce gold, and not much of it is produced on an annual basis. And we've seen central bank buying recently. We saw India buy half of the gold that the IMF was selling, and we know that China has been buying gold, and Russia has been saying that it was going to buy gold. So an increasing number of people, from private investors to central bankers, are saying, well, gold is old money or real money. And the fiat currency world in which we live allows governments to increase the money supply, to print as much money as they wish to. And that means that paper currencies are not backed by anything other than faith. They're faith-based currencies, I've often said, in the case of the U.S. dollar, it's got "In God We Trust," certainly making it a faith-based currency. And the supply is effectively unlimited, so no wonder people like gold, and I certainly like gold and wish to maintain a long position in this environment. Now, I'm going to move on to the next chart, because I'll talk more about consistency characteristics here. And the next chart that you'll see is the UK FTSE 100 Index. Now, if you want to know what reversion to the trend mean looks like, look at the portion of the last bull market that you can still see from 2005 onwards to the left of this chart, and you'll see that every time the FTSE index became overextended relative to the 200-day moving average, that it was susceptible to a pullback to that level. And then, of course, eventually we started to get bigger pullbacks and more volatility in that 2007 period, and began to break more sharply beneath the moving average, which then later turned down. And we had then reversion to the upper side of a declining moving average, and becoming extremely overextended in that October-November period, where you can see the price of the FTSE index accelerating downwards way below the declining moving average in what I think we would all agree was a selling panic. You remember what sentiment was like at that time, and that extreme sell-off we felt was climactic. In other words, a selling climax. Now, I've lived through these before. In 1987, a closer parallel, I really feel, was the 1974 sell-off. And indeed, the 73-74 sell-off was a bigger, longer bear market. And we saw very similar comments during those two declines that I've referred to. People would say, well, it's the end of capitalism as we know it. The stock market will never be the same. It will never recover. They also would say that we're going to see a global depression. And you have probably heard the expression, buy when there's blood in the streets. And it's one that we certainly agree with, that the most frightening times in markets are the real opportunities for investors who have cash and can deploy that cash. And getting back to last October and November's selling climax for us. And you can listen to earlier audios they're now in the public archive, and read what we were saying. For us, the beginning of the end of the bear market is the beginning of the bottoming out and base building process for the next bull market. And that is what we have seen. And it's been a very impressive bull market. I would describe this as a cyclical bull market. I'll explain why in a little longer. But a genuine bull market, remains, in my view. But you can also see that the FTSE index is somewhat overextended relative to that rising 200-day moving average, and it has also lost upside momentum. So we feel that we're in a corrective phase right now, but that markets are remarkably steady within this corrective phase. I'll just go on to the next slide, which is a daily chart of the FTSE 100 index. And again, this will enable me to talk about consistency characteristics. Now, take the move upwards from mid-July, for instance, mid-July 2009 on that chart, and you'll see that starts with, first the FTSE index had been drifting lower for over a month following an earlier loss of momentum. And then it had that big blue candlestick to the upside off the mid-July low. And subscribers will, of course, recognize that as an upside key reversal, a very dynamic signal, which we wrote about at the time. And these are often metaphorical bolts from the blue, in this case, figuratively and literally. You suddenly see this surge of demand, which changes sentiment. And then the bull market resumes, characterized by higher highs and higher reaction lows. And you can see a small reaction low in mid-August and another one in early September. And you can also see another one in early October, marked by a green arrow, and another one right around the end of October, early November, also marked by a green arrow. So higher highs and higher lows, but somewhat of a loss of upside momentum. And you can see that also that 5,000 level, which I've described as a psychological level of some psychological importance. Round numbers often are. They're reassessment points in the markets. More often than not, actually. So you don't need to be a psychiatrist or have a degree in psychology, for instance, to realize that if the FTSE index were to break below that 5,000 level for more than a day or two, in other words, not reverse such a decline very quickly, that sentiment would deteriorate. Now, so far, the index has been very steady, and I don't want to prejudge. We don't tell markets what to do, but we do still feel that there is scope for a further reversion to the mean in terms of that 200-day moving average that you were seeing in the previous slide. Now, whether that occurs primarily with the background of sideways ranging activity or a sharper move back down to the moving average remains to be seen. But we look at all global stock market indices, and I can tell you that some of the indices will remain remarkably steady. Those will be the stronger markets, and any reversion to the mean will be of a sideways nature. Others will combine that with a downward reaction, so they'll break the sequence of higher reaction lows, and some of the weakest stock markets will fall more sharply and not only move back to their 200-day moving averages, but also a break below them. So we'll get all three combinations. But so far, the FTSE index has been very steady. Well, now let's go on to the next slide and look at the Standard & Poor's 500 index. You'll notice, if you can recall, that it looks very similar to the slide that we saw previously when we were looking at the FTSE 100 weekly chart. So the S&P looks very, very similar. You can see on this weekly chart the higher highs and the higher lows. You can also see the loss of momentum. You can also see that it is somewhat overextended relative to the mean represented by that rising 200-day moving average, and therefore susceptible to some mean reversion, which again is why we are saying that markets are in a corrective phase right now. And the extent of the downside, though, we feel at this still comparatively early stage in this cyclical bull market cycle, we feel that the downside for an index such as the S&P 500 is a move back to that rising moving average, not much below it. And again, if you look at the left-hand side of the chart, you'll see the type of action that we saw in the last bull market cycle. So basically, we also feel that reversion to the mean in terms of the moving average is a buying opportunity, but we would be a little bit careful about putting new money, into the stock market today. Can someone ride out a correction towards the mean? Yes, of course. I think medium to longer term investors could certainly do that. But if one is thinking about taking profits on some positions in a portfolio, this is not a bad time to do that, because the chart is suggesting that we're unlikely to see it running away despite the bullish seasonal activity in the near term, and we may see sideways to somewhat lower activity overall. Okay, so that's given me a chance to talk to you about the methodology that we use at Fuller Money. As I say, it's all based on chart facts. You can see the higher highs and the higher lows and the rising moving average. You can also see the overextension relative to that moving average. We're not really interested in chart theory. Now I'm going to move on to something else, which is what's behind the technical action that we see. But first, I'll just draw your attention to this daily chart of the S&P 500 index, which is the next slide. Watch those rising lows on the daily chart. And you'll notice that we'll look first at a weekly chart to have the bigger picture perspective, and sometimes we'll look at monthly charts with a lot of historical data, and then we'll zero in to the more sensitive scale charts, which will be the daily charts, and we can also produce point and figure charts. And this is a customizable library that subscribers have full access to. But looking at the daily chart of the S&P, again, you see the higher highs and the higher lows. You can see that the downward reactions have increased in size recently, and therefore that it is an indication of some loss of upward momentum. And the extensions on the upside, the last one at any rate, wasn't quite as strong as some of the earlier ones following a new recovery high. So that needs to be watched, and any break in the progression of higher reaction lows would certainly encourage bears on Wall Street. Now, I'm just going to go back a slide and look at the weekly chart again, if you don't mind, because I want to make one additional point. And that is, if you look at the high that we saw in the S&P on the weekly chart back in 2007, and you see it's a little below 1600, and it was a bit above 1600 back in 2000 at the top of that bull market. And I feel, and it's very much the fuller money view, something we've mentioned from time to time, that we are probably in what I would describe as a secular bear market. Now, when I say that, very often people hear the word bear market and they become alarmed. The definition of a secular bear market that I would use in this instance is where we see over time in a rolling, not a linear fashion, but where we see some price earnings ratio contraction. In other words, on each downside move and each bearish cycle, PE ratios fall a little bit lower than they did in earlier cycles, and yields also gradually rise over time. Now, that hasn't been the case in terms of this last reaction low because there were so many dividend cuts, but we feel that those dividend cuts against the economic background that we actually face is likely to contain the S&P index to the upper side. I'm thinking in terms of a ceiling for the S&P in the 1600 to 1700 region that could well last for a good many more years, not unlike the glass ceiling that we had for the Dow back in the from the late 1960s through to 1982. Now, during that period, there were plenty of opportunities to make money in stock markets, but we would get cyclical bull markets, which would last for 3 or 4 years, and then we would get a shorter but sharp bear market lasting for the most part, 6 to 9 months, except for the big one, the 72-73 bear market. And we've seen quite a big bear market this time around, so I would be hopeful that that 2009, March 2009 low would hold. But I don't expect the high to be taken out, or certainly not by very much, if monetary policy remains accommodative over the next couple of years. There's a reasonable chance that we would see that high retested, but I don't expect a move very much above it. Okay, let's move on. Now, some people, I describe that as a secular bear market defined by contracting price-earnings ratios and rising yields over time. Some others have referred to it as a fair market, but this is what we're talking jargon. Now I'm going to move on past the daily chart of the S&P to the next slide, which has the heading "Fire Inflation versus Ice Deflation," because this is the great debate that's taking place right now. Are we going to see inflation or are we going to see deflation? And the bullet points indicate some back history plus what I feel we're seeing right now. And my answer to this question of inflation versus deflation is to say that it is normal. In other words, most of the time, we will see pockets of in both inflation and deflation occurring simultaneously. Now, let's consider some of those, and it's important to do so because most people today, I would say, are concerned about deflation. And certainly, if you go back to the fourth quarter of last year or the first quarter of this year, I think practically everybody was concerned about deflation when, in what was clearly an overreaction, they were talking about a global depression. Now, where are we actually seeing the deflation? Clearly in wages, clearly in the prices of some manufactured goods. We have seen some disinflation in terms, in other words, a lower rate of inflation in terms of house price, and in terms of house prices, I would think it would be a bit rich to call the decline in house prices actual deflation, since all that we've seen is a retracement from extreme levels of house price inflation. But these are the areas of deflation that we are actually seeing. But if you pay your household bills, as most of you will, if you are the payer of the household bills, as many of you will be, you will know that the things that you pay mostly on a monthly basis, whether it's your heating bill, food bills, these will actually be rising. Taxes are also rising in the OECD countries, and VAT in the UK is about to go up again. So those are the pockets of inflation. Now, these are all well known, but what's the very big picture looking well into the future? And some people feel that there's quite a high risk that the USA and the UK and much of continental Europe will move into a very deflationary environment, similar to what we have seen in Japan over the last 20 years or so, or ever since that bubble burst back in 1990. Well, that could be the subject of a separate PowerPoint all on its own, but I'll cut to the critical factor here, that every central bank has been very aware of the risk of falling into what people often refer to as a liquidity trap, where you just cannot pull out of that deflationary overall environment. And the Federal Reserve in the USA, for instance, appointed Ben Bernanke, who'd spent his entire career talking or studying and writing and talking about how to avoid a repeat of the 1930s depression. And what we have seen in the last 9 months is nothing less than the greatest expansion of monetary policy in human history. And there's no hyperbole in that description, because all central banks have contributed to this reflationary effort. And we have seen a huge amount of money printing, and we have also seen interest rates in the OECD countries at rock bottom levels. Now, I mentioned the importance of knowing market history, and I'm thinking at this time of the writings of Milton Friedman, as someone I have certainly long admired. And his assessment, if Milton Friedman were alive today and commenting, I have little doubt that he would be saying that this is going to, all this monetary reflation, all of the quantitative easing, printing of money that is taking place, will result in future inflation. Now, how far in the future is that inflation? Nobody knows for sure. I don't think we'll see much of it next year. Hopefully we won't see much of it for 2 or 3 years, in which case the bull market in equities will continue for somewhat longer. In other words, quite a bit longer than what we've seen to date. But I do think that it is something that we need to watch for on the charts, and I'll have more to say on that when we reach charts of the long-dated government bond markets. Okay, now moving on to the next slide, we'll talk about this great debate that has taken place between bulls and bears regarding the stock market. Now, I think much of this debate has been resolved in recent months because the bears have become a little quieter as stock markets have continued to rally. But this debate was certainly very, very active in the fourth quarter of last year and the first quarter of this year. And let's look at what the bears were actually saying, and many have still fretted about this. And tragically, a number of investors have been overly influenced by the arguments that the bears have put forward and have missed the recovery that we've seen. Well, and I'll run through these very quickly. You know, the people have been saying that banks won't lend, and obviously they know they've emphasized the too much debt factor, the unemployment, the deflationary pressures that I was referring to a short while ago, dramatic drop in economic performance that we have seen in the OECD countries and in some of the emerging markets, causing them, people to be very concerned about those risks. I'm thinking particularly of some of the Eastern European stock markets and economies. And they've also pointed out that the global economy is effectively on steroids in terms of this quantitative easing. Now, all of these points are absolutely valid. These are concerns, but the fuller money view earlier in the year and now is that they were irrelevant in terms of what would actually happen to stock markets. And the reason for that is that the stock market is a discounting mechanism. And I would also point out, and you may well have, older investors will have observed this, that if you think back to the 1973 and 1974 bear market, we had similar problems, and of course we had a very, very significant stock market recovery at that time. And if you go back to the 30s, which I do not remember, but I've certainly read about it, we had similar problems as well. Okay, let's go on to the next slide, which is what the bulls have been saying, including Fuller Money, fortunately. And again, I mentioned earlier on the climactic nature of the sell-off and buy when there's blood in the streets. We did have much lower valuations for most stock markets. People become confused on the valuations because they say, yes, but profits are going to go down a great deal. And yes, that's what the bear market was about. We knew that investors had sold very, very aggressively. You could look at the cash in money market funds and in treasury bills to see evidence of that. Interest rates exceptionally low, long-dated government bond yields exceptionally low. And what's become a mantra at Fuller Money over the years is that monetary policy usually trumps all else. Now, that's on both sides. You need an expansionary monetary policy to get a bull market environment. You saw that in what people now refer to as the serial bubble blowing by Alan Greenspan and the U.S. Federal Reserve. We saw it in the 1990s following the long-term capital mismanagement meltdown. We saw it following the Asian financial crisis. Remember the Y2K panic, where again we had another massive liquidity infusion, and then again in earlier this decade, prior to second Gulf War, we saw another massive liquidity infusion, and we have seen, of course, the mother of all liquidity infusions really starting late last year and continuing in many instances today. So that monetary policy usually trumps all else, and I've just mentioned very briefly, the same is true at market tops. Bull markets don't die of old age, as people have often pointed out in the past. They are usually assassinated by central banks through tighter monetary conditions. Okay, so next slide, and who's right? Both earlier on, well, we know the bulls have been right, but who's right today and going forward? And I'll leave the last word to Sir John Templeton as he talks about the stock market or bear markets being temporary and the stock market being a discounting mechanism. Okay, next slide, please. The Fuller Money view on stock markets. So just to summarize very quickly, we maintain that this is a bull market fueled by quantitative easing. And if you want to hear more about our thoughts as they were developed earlier in the year, that information is publicly available in the archives, both in terms of the audios, and the Friday audios go into it in particular detail because they're the big picture, long-term outlook, and also in the copy that was being written. But at this stage, going back to the slide, at this stage of the bull market, I mentioned that the low-hanging fruit has already been picked because we have seen a wonderful recovery. And I also mentioned at the beginning of this slide that a corrective phase is currently underway for global stock markets, and I discussed in detail the mean reversion towards 200-day moving averages. I do feel that monetary policy will remain accommodative for longer. We've seen a few countries raise interest rates a little bit, but New Zealand has done that. I think Israel raised interest rates slightly. A couple of other countries have also raised short-term interest rates, but they're still historically low, and I think they will remain historically low. So the monetary policy still remains extremely accommodative, and I expect that to remain the case well into next year, at least. But it will vary from country to country, and the faster-growing emerging markets are likely to tighten monetary policy well before we see that happen in the OECD economy. So you'll get a preview of the changing attitudes towards monetary policy, starting with the better-performing emerging markets such as China and India. I also mention that the rising tide of liquidity is no longer lifting all boats. And that's because the initial response let me take the latter stages of the bear market. People sell everything that those who are going to panic do, in other words, and they sell heavily and they sell indiscriminately. Then a sentiment begins to improve, and against that background of a massive liquidity infusion, all markets rise. There's a lot of short covering. Everything is seen as oversold. But then, after a significant rise, investors become more discerning and look around. We're back to the global beauty contest, which markets look more attractive. And they abandon some of the what are regarded as the more risky propositions. I mentioned them earlier on, some of the smaller Eastern European and Balkans stock markets. And the Middle Eastern markets have underperformed. Dubai's problems provide one good reason for that. Some of the African stock markets have been weak on concerns over governance. And this is typical of other cycles that we have also seen. And I think that those markets will be candidates for a late run, quite possibly. In other words, if we see this bull market continue for another couple of years or more, and that could easily be the case, albeit punctuated by some lengthy pauses and consolidations. But if we do see the bull market continue for another 2 or 3 years, then what will happen is that some of the leaders, fuller money favorites, which I will come on to shortly, will be driven up to levels that really will qualify as inflating bubbles. And then, therefore, investors will be looking around to say, what's been left behind? What hasn't participated? And at that point, if it's going to happen, and there's a good chance that it will happen, just as we saw back in 2007, you suddenly get African markets and Middle Eastern stock markets taking off. And so there's a possibility that that will happen. And, of course, the charts will show us. I refer to Fuller Money themes in this slide, and I'll talk more about those in a minute. And I also expect that volatility will increase as we go forward. We'll have more of a two-way market, in other words. Okay, let's move on to the next slide, where I show another chart. And this is the Dow Jones World Stock Index. Now, that looks remarkably similar, as you will recall, to the S&P and the UK market. And one of the reasons for that is because Wall Street is a major weighting component for the index. Now, I don't need to dwell on this. I move on quickly to the Emerging Market Index, which has considerably outperformed. You can see it bottomed in October, and when people were panicking again and talking about a depression in the UK and on Wall Street back last February and March, something like the Emerging Markets Index, all that did was retest and rebound very strongly off its lows. And actually, it was completing a base formation in March and April when sentiment was so classically bearish. Now, this is often the case that emerging markets, they're high beta, will fall further in the bear market, but usually recover more quickly because they have the better growth prospects. You can also see that momentum has been waning in recent weeks, and that there is a reversion to the mean vulnerability, but it would require a close below that 900 level for more than a day or two to clearly indicate that we were going to see more downward rather than sideways lateral reversion to the mean. And on the flip side, we would need to see a sustained break above the psychological 1,000 level to indicate that this was resuming. Now, few people are trading. You can't trade the Emerging Market Index, or at least I don't think you can. But it's a good one to watch for an overall indication of how that sector is actually performing. And as I say, it's a top performer. Now we'll move on to the Fuller Money themes with the next slide. And what are these? Well, in terms of global stock markets, it's been very much a case of favoring Asian emerging markets led by China and India. These are the two giants, and particularly China. We've written about this at Fuller Money and spoken about it so many times over the last 8, 9 years. But I remember one subscriber saying to me at a presentation, he said, do you mean we're going back to the 17th century and earlier when China and India were the dominant economies in the world. And my answer is to that is yes, I think that is what we are going to see. Another way to put it is the 19th century belonged to Britain, the British Empire. The 20th century clearly belonged to the USA. And I think that increasingly the 21st century will belong to China and probably India as well. And I think that really in terms of long-term capital appreciation, one really does need to be in these markets. And I want to be there, and I want my children to be there, and I want my grandchildren to be there, and probably my great-grandchildren, who I hope to live to see. Now, the other theme is resources markets, and this is led by Brazil. Now, this is Brazil and China are really a marriage made in heaven, because China is this voracious consumer of natural resources, and Brazil is the world's leading producer of so many of the commodities that China and the rest of the world also need, and not least the rest of the developing world, everything from energy to foods. And governance, incidentally, and we talk a lot about governance. I haven't mentioned it in any of these slides, but at Fuller Money we maintain that governance is everything. I would say, and often mentioned, and we wrote and talked about this, you'll find it in earlier audios, that a failure of governance really led to the credit and insolvency crisis that we saw in the USA and also in the UK. Again, I can't overemphasize the importance of governance, and I would say that the students have become the teachers in recent years, and that's something that happens in other areas as well. But my point is that this authoritarian governance, form of governance, that is not to everyone's tastes in China, but it has proved to be very effective. And I think that the governance in democratic India and Brazil has surprised a lot of people, both in terms of its improvement. That doesn't mean that there aren't plenty of problems and plenty of corruption and so on, but that the trend is towards improvement, and I do feel that we do need to see improving governance in the OECD countries. I would argue that the trend of governance has actually deteriorated over the last 15 years or more, and that is also reflected by markets. Now, more charts. If we go on to the next slide, and I show the Shanghai Composite Index. Again, notice the mean reversion taking place, getting way overextended up at the 2007 peak, and being way overextended down at the bottom. But I want you to look at that bottom area, because if you look at the world, and that's what we endeavor to do, at Fuller Money, and that's what we encourage our subscribers to do, you could see from this chart that China was among the first to peak and go into its bear market, and that's because the Chinese government moved quickly in terms of curbing the overheating bubble. China bottomed in October and clearly had lost downside. That's October of 2008, and clearly had lost downside momentum and shown a great deal of base formation development when people were panicking on Wall Street and in the UK and continental Europe earlier this year, during the first quarter of this year. Actually, China had completed a small base formation and then consolidated above it during the first quarter of this year. You can see that on that chart. Interestingly, China was also the first market to experience mean reversion towards its 200-day moving average, and that it did that with a high in August, and is in, I think, quite a healthy state here today. And one other point that I mention on this, in terms of overall global strategy, I mentioned that we look at so many markets, but we look at some much more than others. And at Fuller Money, we often refer to a leash effect. And we talk about the Wall Street leash effect and also the China leash effect. And by that, they basically mean, think of it in terms of a dog walker out strolling the dog, and there you have Wall Street, which is the dog walker, and the leash is connected to all the other markets. If Wall Street is moving, if Wall Street is steady, let alone moving higher, that enables that leash to be loosened, and the punchier, more dynamic, I should say, markets, particularly emerging markets, will do exceptionally well. Conversely, if Wall Street is weak, the leash contracts, and these high beta markets will actually fall back, and fall back even more than Wall Street. Now, there's also a China leash effect, which is a big influence in Asia and a growing influence, and will become a big influence globally if it isn't already. So we need to watch this quite closely. But the China leash effect is now favorable, and that may be one reason why the Asian stock markets and perhaps those South American resources producers don't fall back as sharply during this mean reversion process as some other markets. But again, I pointed out that China did fall back quite sharply, but then you see it found support above the rising 200-day moving average. It's been support building and is not very overextended today, and we think it will range sideways to higher. Now, those of us in the West can't really buy the A shares very easily, but we can participate via, look at the next slide, which is the H shares in what's known as the Hong Kong Hang Seng China Enterprise Index. And that shows a very clear upward staircase step sequence, higher highs, higher reaction lows. Little bit overextended against the MA, but not seriously. I think this is a buy in this range, and a buy on any additional easing if that actually occurs. Moving on now to the next slide. I'm showing Indonesia, which has been a regional outperformer and produces many of the commodities that China requires. But you can see the loss of upside momentum, and that a period of mean reversion is now occurring. And I think this will continue for a while longer. But I expect eventually, at some point next year, I expect to see this break upwards again and almost certainly take out the former peak. Next slide. I mentioned that China was my favorite stock market for the very long term. A little bit ahead of India. India is earlier in its progression. And incidentally, while people refer to emerging markets, I feel the term is dated and a bit of a misnomer. We use it because people understand immediately what you mean, but I often talk in terms of progressing, and if you have progressing markets, you also have regressing markets, and I don't need to explain any more about that. Others, WAGs, have said emerging and submerging markets. Maybe that's a bit too harsh, but I think that these are definitely progressing markets, China and India. But India is an earlier stage. It has more governance problems. I admire its democracy, but it's unwieldy. It doesn't have the infrastructure development that China has yet, very much needs that. But India has outperformed China overall, and in terms of my own personal portfolio, my India position, due to that outperformance, is actually slightly larger than my China position, but it's China's the one that I'm mainly topping up. One of the reasons for that outperformance by India is that it has fewer public offerings, fewer flotations, whereas if you go back 20-25 years, there were no publicly traded companies in China. Everything was state controlled, whereas India, you know, is a democracy. It also has state controlled companies, but there were private enterprise was a much bigger factor in India. So the biggest problem with China that I have seen and continue to see is dilution in terms of newly floated companies. But I suspect that that's a more of a medium-term problem, and that the longer-term investor interest in China, both from the Chinese and everyone else, will continue to grow and grow substantially. Moving on, next slide. Third favorite market, here's Brazil. I'm talking about now the majors in terms of big countries that are going to be growth giants in the next few decades: China, India, and Brazil. And this has been exceptionally steady, as you can see. Again, I think downside risk is limited to a bit of mean reversion. Any pullback, I think, would be a buying opportunity in this market. And I certainly expect the previous high, that 2008 high, to be exceeded next year. Okay. Another Fuller Money theme is information technology. And you can see the outperformance of information, the U.S. Information Technology Index. This is still very much a USA stronghold, and likely to remain so for at least the next 10 to 20 years. Incidentally, for American investors who want to buy American companies, and British investors who want to buy things that are listed on the London Stock Exchange, I favor the multinationals, the big multinationals that are going to benefit from GDP growth led by China and India. Now, a number of U.S. top flight multinational companies would qualify, but none more so than in the information technology sector, in my opinion. Okay, so what can go wrong? We're in a cyclical bull market. I feel that it has further to go because monetary conditions are quite positive. What will eventually go wrong? And I've sometimes referred to this slide as sort of paranoid's corner, but we do need to think ahead about what will eventually happen. And one is that bubbles form. I think that's almost inevitable. And I've said equities and commodities question mark, and I don't really feel I need the commodities question mark all that much. I've said earlier this year on a number of occasions that we could already see where the next bubbles would occur because they were leading the way back up, and those were stock markets and commodities. Now, in the dismal science of bubbleology, there's a tendency for people, and I'm going to make an unkind comment, but I trust you'll forgive me for this, but and people who have missed out on a market, any market that's rising that they missed out on gets described as a bubble. And my personal view here today is that we will eventually see bubbles in a number of stock markets and commodities, but that we are not there yet. And people talk about gold, and the gold bears have described it as a bubble for several years. Well, I can remember, and some of the older listeners will remember, 1978 and 1979 and early 1980, when we really did see a bubble in gold, and we saw genuine gold fever. It was a mania. We haven't seen anything like that in this cycle to date. And you can think of other bubbles, the tech and telecom bubble, people describing it as a new paradigm, and so on. Now, the way to spot bubbles is that first, everybody will genuinely be involved. They will describe it as a new paradigm and the best thing ever, and they'll talk about it uncoupling from everything else. But you'll see it best of all on the charts, because there'll be just a screaming big advance that accelerates higher. And we are not there, needless to say. Now, monetary policy. I mentioned earlier on in this broadcast that bull markets don't die of old age, that they are assassinated, usually by central banks, in terms of monetary policy tightening. It usually takes several interest rate hikes before that starts to drag markets down, because the first few are rationalized away. People say, well, they're tightening monetary policy because growth is very good, and growth will be good or better than it is today when they're tightening monetary policy. I think I have little near-term risk of significantly tighter monetary policy. Therefore, we still have accommodative monetary policy. So this is a problem for the future. Now, long-term interest rates, going back to Milton Friedman talking about the inflation concerns, I do expect long-term interest rates to rise significantly at some point. That is obviously not a problem today. And one of the main reasons, the main reason for that, is the quantitative easing in which governments have been buying their own long-dated government bonds to keep yields low. The U.S. has consistently bought most of its treasury flotations for a number of months since the whole process of quantitative easing commenced. Crude oil. That's a danger one. If we see crude oil prices spike higher, that will be a serious concern. More on that in a moment. And will we have a currency crisis? People do fear that the U.S. dollar might collapse. A collapsing dollar has not been a fuller money theme. A soft dollar has been a fuller money theme. In other words, we have not been looking for a collapse of the U.S. dollar. There's no particular reason why that should occur. We think in terms of fiat currencies and what has also been a mantra at Fuller Money is that in today's competitive environment of globalization, we've been saying this for years, that no country wants a strong currency. However, excuse me, some countries need a weak currency more than others, and that is reflected in the markets, and the U.S. has certainly needed a weaker currency, as has the U.K., and they've seen it. But it's not in the U.S.'s interest to have the dollar collapse, and it's not in anyone else's interest either. And I don't think it will happen. But more importantly, the charts will tell us, and I'll have a little bit more to say on that before I finish this audio. A geopolitical event, something that nobody's talking about today, that could well be a factor. You know, that usually falls into the black swan category, and people have wondered recently about Dubai and then the Greece debt problems, Eastern Europe. These are concerns. They're always concerns. I don't see any of those as significant enough to derail the recovery fueled by quantitative easing in the United States, or let alone the growth that we're seeing in China and India. Next slide. I often refer in my audios to, and sometimes the writing, to canaries in the coal mine. And as I say in the brackets, that fortunately these are still chirping. But these are items that I touched on the earlier slide. Long-dated government bond yields. when those spike upwards, we will have a lot to worry about in terms of stock market performance and also commodity performance. The U.S. dollar, in case I don't want to be complacent about anything, but the dollar is not collapsing. As a matter of fact, it's steadied last week, and most notably on Friday. Crude oil, we'll look at that chart. That's the one that concerns me the most, but it's not a problem today. So, looking at charts of these instruments, the next chart shows U.S. 10-year Treasury yields over 50 years. And I just want you to see that for its historic perspective, as it'll show you what can happen and when people are seriously worried about inflation. And it's important, I feel, for all investors to know today that yields reached almost 16% and actually moved above 16% in the UK, 10-year gilts, back in the early 1980s. So it's happened before, and it can happen again, but what you also see on this chart is the remarkable bull market reflected by declining yields. Just for in terms of pure perspective, you don't need to be an analytical genius to appreciate the next move, that the next significant move is likely to be higher. Or will it? Well, let's look at the next chart. Now, that's a weekly chart of the same treasuries, so we're increasing the magnification in terms of looking at the more recent history more closely. And I've drawn that green line there at 4%, because that's a bell-ringing level for me. Once we see those U.S. 10-year yields moving above 4%, and the main reason they haven't so far is quantitative easing, as I've mentioned before. The U.S. government buying most of its own debt. But eventually, we will see a move back above 4%, and that ought to ring alarm bells for you. It certainly will here. And when we get back up to 5%, then I think we have to be on bear market alert for equities. Now, there are some people, a number of people, who feel that no, we are going to see a Japanese-style situation, and I would not regard that personally as more than a 30% possibility. I think it's 70 to 30 in favor of these yields moving upwards significantly from current levels rather than significantly lower. But if I'm wrong on that, and we do fall into a Japanese-style liquidity trap, and you see those yields moving much below 3%, then that will also become a headwind for global stock markets, because people would say, no, we're going into a deflationary cycle. And if you get back down at 2%, that's sort of depression discounting levels, and I would expect that to be very bearish for stock markets were it to happen again. So right now, we're in a sweet spot, but I will be watching this, and I think that any serious investor should be watching it. Moving on to the next chart, the U.S. dollar index over nearly 50 years. And that's just useful for perspective, and you can see that it has retraced that advance. That I'm now going to move on to a weekly chart and recommend that you do so for the U.S. dollar index. And you can see, again, look at the usefulness of that trend smoothing device, the 200-day moving average, and you can see the U.S. dollar index breaking down in March of 2008 to a new all-time low, then steadying, forming that little base formation, and then breaking upwards in July and August of last year, and getting a very big rally as the financial crisis unfolded. And that struck some people as a paradox, but it makes a lot of sense, because during the panic, two things happened. First, American, European investors, because Sterling had a pretty good move then as well, but European and U.S. investors in particular, pulling money back home, taking money back home. So pulling out of the China and India investments and other overseas diversifications. And then internationally, a lot of people looking for a temporary safe haven moved into the U.S. currency and treasury markets because those are the most liquid markets in the world. But these were always going to be temporary positions. Since people, as I say, were just looking for that bolt hole during a time of crisis and putting a priority on market liquidity. And then, of course, there's the momentum of trends. People saw the dollar going up, and what any good Forex trader is going to do is to say that's the trend, and I'm going to move with it. Well, you can see that move's been largely unwound as investors have readjusted their expectations, and as we've seen a return towards more normal risk expectations in markets generally. But what you don't see on that chart is a bit of a break upwards coming on Friday of last week. You do see some overextension to the downside against the relative to the 200-day moving average, and it's also has come back to the top side of that base that I referred to from March and July of 2008. So the dollar has steadied up here, and that will have implications for other markets as well. Let's move on to the next slide, which is crude oil. We're still reviewing these canary in the coal mine situations. As I said, treasuries are not a problem today. We're in a sweet spot on treasury yields. The dollar, I do not feel, is a problem right now. And the soft dollar has helped the U.S. economy, and I think we'll continue to help it. I just look for a technical rally in the dollar, short covering rally. It has been the favored currency trade, and so we'll see a bounce. But I then think we're likely to see some additional retest by the dollar of its 2008 base formation, largely because I don't think we're going to see the sort of financial crisis that would cause a sharp rebound in the dollar, and again with people seeking a temporary safe haven there. I don't see the environment for that in the short term. Now, but looking at this chart of crude oil here, certainly the trend is upwards overall, but it's not running away to the upside. It's a gradual ranging trend overall, but this needs to be watched very closely, because if there's any market that does concern me, it is crude oil, which is the most important most important commodity in the world by far in terms of production and consumption. Now, if you go on to the next slide, I'll discuss this. And this is an old slide that I used in October 2008 when I was appearing at the Contrary Opinion Conference in Vermont, put on by Fraser Management Associates. A wonderful conference, incidentally. I took the original data that I had then, and you'll see it on the fourth bullet point down. It still contains the Goldman Sachs forecast for 2008, when we didn't get to the $200, but we certainly had a spike in crude oil, as you saw on the previous chart. But basically, I think the criteria that I've identified here still apply in terms of where we see problems. And I think if you start to get, I will become concerned when I see the next break above $80. When I see a sustained break above $80, that will worry me. And if it moves up slowly, I think the global economy can cope with it. Speed is a major factor, but if it spikes higher, then I think we're going to have a problem, and we need to be concerned about this. Now, how quickly will this happen in terms of peak oil? And at Fuller Money, we think of peak oil in terms of the average cost of production. I am more hopeful today than I would have been a few years ago in terms of an energy crisis. And one of the reasons for that is because part of the reason for that decline in the crude oil price that we saw on the earlier chart, obviously we had the global recession. It wasn't quite a global recession. China and India, for instance, and a few other economies never fell into recession, but they certainly experienced a growth, what's known as a growth recession. And the recession was quite sharp elsewhere, as you know, and not least in the OECD economies. So demand for oil fell. And despite some OPEC cutbacks, there has been ample crude oil supply available. But also, the alternatives to crude oil, alternative forms of energy, are increasing. And most of these are subsidized, and quite rightly so, because another spike upwards in the price of crude oil would be devastating for the global economy. Incidentally, I maintain that the spike that we saw in 2008 was far more damaging for much of the world, and particularly the developing world, than the currency, than the credit and insolvency crisis that we saw emanating from Wall Street. Spikes in crude oil, whether in the 70s or the 80s or in 2008, have always caused recessions, and last year was no exception. But the point I would make, which makes me cautiously hopeful, is that if we consider the alternative forms of energy, nuclear, now that's not going to increase energy dependence on oil dramatically in the short term, but it will in the medium to longer term. it's not doing all that much in the short term because there's a big lead time, at least 5 years in terms of developing these plants. But China is leading the way with a massive number of new nuclear power stations under development. So that will eat into the demand for crude oil. Then we have the biofuels. Well, that's an industry that Brazil has led, and it made it almost self-sufficient through biofuels alone, although it's also a producer in crude. And over the next 10 years, we'll develop a major crude oil offshore field, which is currently known. It's been discovered, but it has not been developed yet. It'll take a number of more years before it is developed, because the technology is very challenging. But these technologies are being developed. We have other biofuels will be produced. We have solar power. We have wind power. Now, these make a tiny contribution so far, but it is an increasing contribution, and it does buy a little bit of time. Algae, I think, is not contributing anything yet, but could be quite important in the decades ahead. So really, I see and have seen for some time an environment where the world is in a race against time, where we need to have these alternative forms of energy to avoid a depression-inducing spike in the price of crude oil to $200, $300, something horrific, horrific like that. So hopefully that type of crisis will be avoided. And then I should also mention natural gas, because the major breakthrough in the last couple of years has been the ability to retrieve natural gas that was previously locked in shale rock. And that has transformed the U.S. natural gas industry, and the same technology is now being used in Europe to what will be increasingly good effect, and elsewhere. But again, crude oil, much above $100, and I think we would have a problem, and a spike from 80 to 100 would certainly create a headwind for stock markets. Okay, we're getting to the end of what must be a world record broadcast here in terms of length from Fuller Money. Commodities, super cycle or bubble. Well, Fuller Money, the Fuller Money theme is that this is a commodity super cycle following the 21-year bear market that ended in 2001. Gold is the upside leader, but it's including the move includes most commodities. And the theme that we've used for that is supply and elasticity meets rising demand. Supply and elasticity in the sense that it is very difficult to increase the production for these commodities. And the rising demand goes with population and GDP growth. That demand will be blighted by a recession. What happens, and what we've seen over the last year, and what was predictable, is that recessions will interrupt the secular bull trend that we see in commodities, but not derail it in our view. So as soon as the global economy starts to recover, we see commodities beginning to push higher once again. And again, drivers behind this, it is finite supply for most of these commodities and rising production costs in addition to rising demand. And looking at currencies, I asked the question in this slide, how concerned do we need to be? Well, vary in the sense that currencies are not going to hold their purchasing power. Fiat currencies, which we have never held their purchasing power, and therefore we do need alternative investments. We need equities. We need commodities. We need property. We need diversification into collectibles, all of which are best purchased, not surprisingly, when there are market shakeouts and recessions. So I do feel that we will see inflationary problems in the longer term future, not in the short term future, and possibly not in the medium term future, which at Fuller Money is anything up to a couple of years. The currencies that we tend to like during the growth periods, and not tend to like, we definitely like during the growth periods, are the resources producers and the Asian currencies. But as the last bullet point on the slide says, when we have recessionary environments or any form of global crisis, then you can expect a knee-jerk response going into mainly the U.S. dollar, but that will often lift sterling and the yen with it. Incidentally, the yen is the currency that most needs to weaken in terms of Japan's economy and Japan's poor economic performance. I think and poor stock market performance owes a great deal to the weakness of the the strength of the Japanese yen, and a weaker yen, which we saw last week, is essential to improve Japan's performance overall. Okay. I'll move quickly on these last slides, but you'll see the sterling trade-weighted index. Sterling remains a soft currency generally. The more important one is the Asian currency index, which is the following slide. Again, I emphasize, this is Asian currencies, a good place to be when the global economy is expanding, growing, when GDP growth is rising, but one wants to be out during the recession periods. And the ditto for the next slide, the Latin American currency index. And just a quick summary on that in terms of Fuller Money favorites now, moving on to the next slide. In terms of stock markets, China, India, and Brazil for growth. And we also resources and elsewhere, leading multinationals, as I mentioned earlier on, that benefit from the global growth story, and not least in information technology. And I think that we can play this bull market as long as the overall upward trends are intact. I'm optimistic that these will continue for at least another year. But we certainly want to be on a bear market alert when the U.S. yield curve next inverts. And that's the next slide. While we don't need to look at the yield curve chart all that often, it's probably one of the most important ones that are listed in the chart library. In this presentation, it's slide 38, and I apologize for not having mentioned the slide numbers earlier on in this broadcast. But as you can see, the yield curve, which measures the spread between the U.S. 10-year bond yield and the U.S. 2-year bond yield, you can see that in the label just above the chart grid. And you can see that it remains firm at about 2.5, up near previous highs. That's a healthy yield curve in terms of the stock market, because it indicates that monetary conditions are still quite favorable. Short-term rates are well below those of longer-term rates. Now, when the yield curve eventually inverts by moving below that zero line, which has the turquoise bar running across it, stock markets will definitely be on a bear market watch. Fortunately, this is also a lead indicator, and therefore it's going to give you a bearish reading in all likelihood before the stock market actually tops out, or at least early on in the topping out process. Now, you can see this because the yield curve had dropped down to below zero in early 2006, and obviously that wasn't the beginning of the bear market, but it was at an advanced stage or of the bull run, and we had certainly seen the best of the bull market for a number of equities, although not all of the emerging markets at that stage. It then popped back up to a slightly positive level before then moving back down in late 2006 and in 2007. Now, as I've said, when that next happens, when the yield curve next inverts, I will feel that we really are on bear market watch at that stage, and we really should be reducing equity exposure. Now, let's move on through the remaining slides here, when I will endeavor to cover these fairly quickly. So, first, a quick review of Fuller Money Favorites. That's slide number 39. And in commodities, I mentioned gold, silver, platinum, and copper, while also mentioning that they were in a corrective phase here in the short term. And also, we like other commodities, again, subject to the chart performance in the charts that, I'll wait till we actually get to those charts, but you'll see more base formation development in this sector. I should add that most of the industrial metal charts all of the industrial metal charts look bullish. I hesitated there for a moment because nickel has been lagging recently, but they all show underlying base formations and are in varying stages of consolidations within overall upward trends. Now, in terms of our technical guidance, I do feel that it is important to sell when the primary upward trends lose momentum, and not least as central banks will hike rates to fight inflation risks at some point in the future. I don't think that's an immediate risk by any means, as you know, but we will have to watch out for that, and the evidence of that monetary squeeze again will be reflected by the inverted yield curve. Now, moving on to slide 40, we're looking at gold again. This is a shorter term or shorter back history, whereas I had originally put up a 10-year chart of gold. We're now looking at a 5-year chart, and you can see the surge up towards the 1200 level, becoming overextended, as I had described it in my presentations last week. And you can see also that gold had pulled quite sharply up and away from that rising 200-day moving average. So I think we will see a consolidation at this point. My feeling is that we're unlikely to see a major long pause at this stage. In other words, I don't think it's going to be anywhere near as dramatic a pullback as we saw in it's looks like about the in the second quarter of 2006, and again in the second quarter of 2008, following those big peaks. I think the more likely parallel would be if you look at activity towards year-end 2007. Towards year-end 2007, there's a trading range centered on the $800 level, and gold moved down to, looks like, a low at about 780, and then a high up around the perhaps the 840 region, and we then saw a consolidation in that range. So I think we'll see something like that between the lower 1100 region and the $1200 region, possibly lasting for a few weeks. Just to give a little bit of mean reversion there, because the 200-day moving average will continue to rise, but basically it's a consolidation of that short-term overextended condition, and then I do expect the bull trend in gold to continue upwards, and I think I said to at least $1,300 before we start to have to perhaps worry, see if we're going to see a repeat of the weakness that has often occurred commencing at some point in the second quarter of the year, the seasonal weakness, and lasting through the third quarter of the year. And of course, this is a chart that we can look at every day, and one can create all sorts of gold charts in the library. One of the ones that, among the ones that we like to look at most, are charts of gold in other currencies, and they're all available to subscribers in the chart library. Moving on to slide number 41, silver I regard as high beta gold, and in other words, it'll outperform gold often on the upside and also on the downside. It's just more volatile generally. Now, it hasn't outperformed on the upside in this cycle, at least since the October 2008 lows, as you can see. I think that's because gold, really with all the interest and focus on it that has occurred in recent months, and with central banks, but when investors were used to central banks selling gold, they have been less used to central banks buying gold. And when India bought half of the IMF gold that was available for sale, that galvanized people's attention, and gold bullion raced further into the leadership position. But what this silver chart does show clearly is, I would say, is a good clear upward trend, and we can see some support below the $18 level, which I feel will probably cushion downside risk during this present consolidation, and I would expect the high, that high that you see above $21, to be taken out before the end of the first quarter of this year. That's my expectation, of course. Now, in other words, there are no facts with forecasts, but I certainly see the potential for that type of move. Now, on to slide 42, which is platinum, and this is one of the metals that does interest me most. It is a precious metal, of course, a very valuable precious metal, and it also has major industrial uses in the electronics industry, but the biggest demand for platinum comes from the catalytic converter market, and that's for pollution control exhaust systems in automobiles and trucks. Now, platinum I feel, has lagged during this recovery because people were so concerned about the U.S. and European automobile industry against the background of a recessionary environment, and rightly so. We certainly have seen a drop-off in demand both in North America and in Europe for automobiles. But what many people have perhaps not quite realized is that China is now outselling the USA in terms of new automobile purchases, and that's a trend that is probably permanent, given the size of China's population and the rapid growth that's occurring within the economy. So in Asia, led by China, the demand for automobiles is booming now, and I expect that to continue, and I also expect some recovery in demand in the West. Certainly next year, I think, as the global economy does continue to improve. Now, that spike that you see back in 2008, in the first quarter of 2008 for platinum, really occurred, the last part of the spike occurred because of a power outage in South Africa, which meant that there were fears of supply scarcity. And I don't expect that problem to be repeated. I mean, it could be in theory, but it's certainly not something that we can count on. But I would mention that most of the platinum produced comes from South Africa, and I think it's around the 90% level on the last data that that I saw. So if anything goes wrong in terms of the power grid or in terms of strikes in South Africa, that can boost production really quite dramatically. Now, there are no problems that I'm aware of with production at the moment, and so the price action is more sedate. But when we are reliant on one country for production, the risks of something going wrong are often a little bit higher. Without any problems in South Africa, I would still expect the demand for platinum from industry and also those who are interested in gold and silver, also, as I am, also being interested in platinum as I remain, will support this market, which does show a very clear and orderly upward trend. It would be maybe unrealistic to expect a move back up to the 2200 level anytime soon, but we're a long way away at 1440 or so here right now, and I think that platinum does still have a considerable amount of overall upside potential. But watch the chart trend, of course, and you can see a nice orderly progression of higher reaction lows. And while it's a little overextended relative to the rising moving average, it's not very overextended. So the worst I would expect is some dull ranging from this market. Moving on to slide 43, soybeans. I had referred to this when I mentioned other commodities. I was thinking of soybeans, in other words. And you can see part of the previous base formation from 2005 into 2007, when prices took off on some production problems. You can see today, looking on the right-hand side of this graph, you can see some extensive ranging, which I feel is base formation development overall, and I do expect this to lead to higher prices in any environment other than unbelievably attractive yields for soybeans. In other words, with agricultural commodities, supply will be the key variable. And if you have just perfect conditions around the world, then you will certainly have a surplus, and that would weigh on the price. But if problems occur, and almost invariably they do every year somewhere or other, that will help to support prices. And I would expect demand for soybeans to be rising as the global economy recovers. Next slide, 44, rough rice. This shows very clearly that rounding base formation, and again, as with soybeans, you can see the latter part of base formation development that occurred in the last cycle. And that spike caused very considerable problems in some of the poorer countries, particularly in Asia, that are very where the diet is very much rice-based. It's a key staple. And the bias is upwards once again. And again, production will be the key variable here, but demand is rising in line with economic growth and population growth overall. If we do get spikes in food commodities, those are very emotional developments, generating real fear, not only among people in terms of their dietary requirements, but also governments and their central banks. And I think that I felt for a long time that when we get tighter monetary policies, that it will be commodity price inflation that will force the hand of central banks more than any other single factor. Now, whether we get that commodity price inflation, clear evidence of inflation, sooner or later remains to be seen. But the key ones in terms of concern for governments will be not gold, although people regard gold as an inflation indicator, but gold tends to outperform during deflationary periods. Gold will be quite volatile, as you have certainly seen. But people buy gold. The point I'm trying to make is that people buy gold for a number of different reasons, and I think it's as a hedge against paper currencies that has created most of the investment demand over the last few years, rather than any serious rise in overall inflationary pressures. But there's no doubt that the most important commodities to watch in terms of inflationary concerns for populations at large and governments and their central banks, it would be crude oil, as I mentioned earlier at some length, and it would also be these key agricultural commodities. And the price for most of these key agricultural commodities is beginning to move higher, and has moved significantly higher with some of the with some of the commodities, such as sugar and cocoa. But the grain and bean complex will be the most important. Okay, now more on the Fuller Money favorites, and this is my penultimate slide. Here, 45. I've run through stock markets, again, the Fuller Money themes, Asian emerging markets, and resources markets, big multinational companies that are leaders in their industries and that benefit from globalization. In other words, they have markets in many different countries, not least the U.S. Information sector, and indeed the global information sector, information technology, provided we're talking about leading companies. Those are very much Fuller Money favorites. I've mentioned during the growth years are preference for commodities and also for Asian currencies, Asian emerging market currencies, I should say, and also the resources producers' currencies. But again, they will weaken when we get the recessionary moves. And last but not least, just a review on these treasuries, that I do feel for those who are inclined to deal in the futures markets, and they're certainly not for everyone, but that the over the long term yields for treasuries, gilts, eurobonds are likely to rise quite significantly in response to all the quantitative easing and printing of money that we have actually seen. And that will create short selling opportunities for those who are inclined to trade in those markets. And even more importantly, I should say to investors who may well be in government bonds today, that you do need to be concerned about this longer term outlook, because we are likely to see a major bear market in global bonds. And when those yields, as I have mentioned before, when they start to, U.S. Treasury, 10-year treasuries, when they start to get up to 5% or higher in the USA, I do feel there's quite a high risk that we will be in bear market territory or very close to it for equity markets. Well, if you're still with me, you get a medal for persistence here. So I'll just say on slide 46, I'll just say thank you very much. For newcomers to the For Money Global Strategy Service site, I should mention that there is a free comment of the day. That's an abbreviated comment of the day that you can sign on for. You can also investigate the Fuller Money site extensively, because all the subscriber area copy and the audios is posted in the public area after 4 months. In other words, obviously subscribers are seeing our new audios and full comment of the day on a daily basis. But 4 months after any Fuller Money copy is released, it then moves into the public domain. So you can review that and listen to earlier audios and see what we were saying at any previous time in the market cycles that interests you. And of course, we feel that subscribers who are interested in global markets, who are interested in monitoring markets by using charts, subscribers who like the overall Fuller Money approach, or investors rather, who like the overall Fuller Money approach, may well wish to become subscribers. And it would be Owen's and my pleasure to welcome you to the service should you decide to subscribe. And meanwhile, I will just say again, thank you for your interest and all the very best.